Thank you for donating almost $70,000 to Issues Etc. in the past 3 weeks. With 2 weeks left in 2018, we're $35,000 short of projected expenses. Please consider making a year-end tax-deductible gift online at issuesetc.org. You can also contribute by check, make your check payable to Issues Etc., and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois 62234. Thanks for listening, and thanks for thinking of Issues Etc. at the end of the year.
The day I started to stop being a feminist was the day I saw, you know, the positive pregnancy test.
Now in the 21st century, if you want terrorism, you go to Islam. That's where you find it.
Sexuality and the practice of sexual intercourse implies commitment and fidelity.
We don't preach the gospel to people to make them comfortable with sin. We preach it to comfort them when they sin.
Radio operators, commercial and amateur alike, just love Issues Etc.
If you are even casually acquainted with conversations about the U.S. Constitution, you've heard it before. The Constitution is a living document. There's a living Constitution way of thinking about this founding document in the U.S. What does that mean, and what's the alternative approach? Where did the idea of a living constitution come from? Where has it brought us, and where might it take us in the future? Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to conclude our series on the U.S. Constitution, talking about that idea of a living constitution. Dr. Russell Dawn joins us. He's Associate Professor of History and Political Thought and Director of the Pre-Law Program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. He holds a Juris Doctor degree from the University of Colorado, and he's a contributor to The Federalist. Dr. Dawn, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
We hear it all the time, but I don't know that it's often explained. What is the idea of a living constitution?
It's a constitution that can evolve with the times without going through the amendment process. This evolution usually comes in the form of loose, often really inventive interpretations of the Constitution. And those interpretations come from whichever branch is seeking to make the Constitution conform to that branch's desires. Most significantly, nowadays, this happens in the judicial system.
By way of frame of reference, what are the other prominent approaches to the Constitution apart from the living Constitution interpretation?
Well, the most prominent alternative is an originalist understanding, and even originalism has a variety of forms. The one that I think is the most sound is that we should be interpreting the Constitution according to its original meaning. Now, sometimes people will talk about originalism in the form of original intent, but intent can be very difficult to determine. You know, do we get into legislative history? Whose intent matters? Because, you know, there were many drafters of this document. Madison was the main one, but Madison doesn't equal the Constitution. So I think original intent is difficult to get at. Original meaning is much better, and it actually fits with sort of a Lutheran hermeneutic of Scripture. Well, what did the Scripture mean originally? So an original meaning approach looks at the words and what those words meant according to their commonly accepted meaning at the time the words were written. So in the case of most of the Constitution, 1787, in terms of the various amendments, whenever those amendments were adopted. So that's the alternative. And it really, to me, is by far the best alternative, because that's the whole purpose of having a written Constitution, is that it means something and that meaning is enduring.
The consequences of the living constitution approach have been almost incalculable, but give us some examples of the results from this approach to the Constitution.
Okay. For instance, states cannot treat abortion as murder. It's been ruled unconstitutional for states to do so. They have to treat it as a woman's right. But there's nothing in the language of the Constitution recognizing such a right. Instead, the Supreme Court has read such a right into the document. Another example, is that states are not permitted to recognize that marriage is and only is a union of a man and a woman. Again, there's no language to this effect in the Constitution. The Constitution doesn't mention marriage, but the Supreme Court has read this restriction onto the states in the form of a right to marry someone of the same sex. Another one, this one's slightly or quite a bit less controversial, really. We interpret freedom of speech in the First Amendment to mean freedom of expression. So this covers forms of communication that aren't speech, such as burning of an American flag, that's protected expression, or engaging in exotic dance in exchange for money. The Supreme Court has ruled that to be a form of expression, and these are protected from government exclusion or limitation. Part of the reason this interpretation is less controversial is that it cuts both ways. So in terms of recent events, it could be seen that the baking of a wedding cake, even without any words on the cake, is a form of protected expression because the wedding cake itself is a symbol that a wedding is taking place. So, as I say, the idea of symbolic speech cuts both ways. But the whole idea, really, of how this interpretation happens is parallel to how we read Scripture. So we ought to be reading meaning out of Scripture. What is the meaning that Scripture itself has? And that becomes binding upon us, rather than our reading meaning into the Scripture and taking our ideas and forcing them into Scripture when they're not meant to be there because God didn't have them there in the first place.
This is a kind of a basic of human communication that any text, you're talking there about Holy Scripture, the U.S. Constitution, the writings of William Faulkner, whatever they may be, ought to be read according to the text in a simple and plain way before anyone begins to wonder or speculate, much less assert, that things are being said that may not be in the text itself.
Correct. At least that's my interpretation, my approach to texts. And I think I'm certain that's quite out of style in English departments across the country. But that's okay. I'm used to being out of style.
So we're talking here about something that is very far removed from the original purpose of the Constitution. How did we get to the living Constitution point?
There are several pieces that needed to be put in place before the Constitution could be read in this way as thoroughly as it is being read these days, as thoroughly as it's being transformed, I guess is what I mean by that. The first step is something we talked about in an earlier episode. State governments, especially in the southern states, abused their authority over people by sanctioning slavery and everything connected to slavery. So that after the Civil War, our response to this abuse was to adopt the 14th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment requires states to protect people equally under the law, regardless of their race or previous condition of servitude, and it forbids states from taking away someone's life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So that wording, life, liberty, or property without due process of law, that's already in the Fifth Amendment, but that applies to the federal government. So now this takes that requirement and places it on the states. So in this way, the federal constitution, which had until that time mostly controlled the federal government, now drastically increased its control over the state governments.
We have talked extensively in this series about the progressive era and its thinking. Was that another piece that brought us the living constitution approach?
It was indeed. Now, again, this thinking, this progressive era thinking, gained popularity partly in response to real problems. And that's usually the case. Sometimes we have some of our worst ideas that come up in order to fix existing problems. So some state governments, again, had been abusing their authority, this time by perpetuating cozy relationships with large corporations. And in effect, they gave these large corporations outsized power over the state governments and therefore over the people. In response to this, Americans saw the federal government as the protector of the people, the protector of liberty, rather than as a threat to liberty as it used to be perceived. And so the people increasingly sought to, well, first of all, popularize control, so the people having control rather than the corporations, and then also to centralize control in the federal government being powerful enough to fight these trusts, as they were called back in the day. Some of this progressive era thinking took the form of constitutional amendments, as we talked about earlier. Some of it came to the fore in the progressivist idea of a living constitution.
What other pieces were needed to get to where we are today?
Well, all that was really left was for the idea of a living constitution to take firm hold in the judicial branch. This took longer than it did in the other branches. It was in the 1940s that the Supreme Court really warmed to the idea, and the process accelerated in the 60s and 70s. The Supreme Court increasingly interpreted the Constitution, and especially the 14th Amendment, as protecting loosely defined or even undefined rights created by the court itself. Thus, rather than the words of the Constitution defining our fundamental laws in accordance with the will of the people, remember the Constitution was adopted state by state, ratifying convention, now the court defines our fundamental laws in accordance with the moral sensibilities that happen to prevail among a majority of those 9 justices.
Dr. Russell Dawn is our guest. It's the conclusion of our series on the U.S. Constitution. We're talking about the idea of a living constitution. When we come back, do the framers want the judiciary to be an interpretive body? If you've enjoyed listening to Issues Etc. this year, please consider making a year-end tax-deductible donation to support this worldwide outreach. You can contribute by check, make your check payable to Issues Etc., and send it to Issues Etc., Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also make a year-end tax-deductible gift online at issuesetc.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for keeping Issues Etc. in mind at the end of 2018.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR9. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Hi. I'm Pastor Palmer from Catalina Lutheran Church in sunny Tucson, Arizona. We're a confessional, liturgical, hymn-singing, Bible-teaching, gospel-preaching congregation, and we would love to share God's good gifts of word and sacrament with you. Look us up online at catalinalutheran.org or give us a call at 520-825-9255. God be with you.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/lcmsu.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We are concluding our series on the U.S. Constitution with Dr. Russell Dawn of Concordia University, Irvine, California, on this Thursday afternoon, talking about the idea of a living constitution. Dr. Dawn, did the framers want the judiciary to be an interpretive body?
Well, they wanted all three branches to be interpretive, since they're all charged with upholding the Constitution. But the idea of judicial review of legislative actions had a long, slow, controversial development over the centuries in England. And it isn't stated in the Constitution exactly what the judicial role would be. But Alexander Hamilton does seem to embrace judicial review in Federalist Number 78. And the Supreme Court's ruling, basically the Supreme Court's sort of appropriating of that role to itself in the early 19th century, has never been seriously threatened.
Now, many people would be stunned to find out that that was not, although you did mention Madison there, that was not explicit in the Constitution as to the Supreme Court or the judicial branch's function there, because many just considered the judicial branch, in particular the Supreme Court, that is its sole function is judicial review.
Right. And it certainly that is its most prominent role now. But I think there's an extent to which the role was not defined because it was known within the existing judiciary what their role was. It wasn't those who were framing the Constitution weren't really interested in redefining the role. So the question is, what would that role be at a federal level? Because state-level judges knew what their role was. So now just we're going to just have judges at the federal level, and they'll do what judges do. So it was only just over a decade before it was determined what that is to include judicial review.
So how did this idea of a living constitution shift the focus of the court away from, ironically, the text of the Constitution?
Yes, there are times when I just have to shake my head that we're even having to have this conversation. Well, once the Constitution becomes organic and evolving, a living text, the text itself doesn't matter much anymore. What does matter is what the final authority on the Constitution thinks the Constitution ought to say. And that final authority, as it has played out over time, is the Supreme Court. There are those who think that the Supreme Court ought not to be the final authority, but that is where we are, at least as a de facto matter. So once we're in that realm, the realm of what the Constitution ought to say, we're really just dealing with the moral vision of at least five members of this extremely elite body of nine individuals. And this gets us to the crux of the matter, to the heart of what's really going on in many of the landmark cases over the last half century or more. We're talking about the morality of elite culture, secularized culture, is being imposed upon the nation, even in places where culture and morality are very different from those of the secular elites.
I want you to go into a little more detail on that. What do you mean by the morality of the elite culture is imposed on the nation?
An example should help. In the 1960s, many people and their representatives in state government wanted to preserve and encourage traditional sexual morality. They saw broad access to birth control as undermining that morality, or at least as potentially undermining that morality. Now, we can argue about whether states were wise to regulate in this way, but the regulation of health, safety, welfare, and morals of the people has always been seen as squarely within the power of the states. In other words, the idea that we can't legislate morality is a bit misleading because although states can't force people to change their moral views, states can and do force people to live according to certain moral rules. Just as states enforce a traditional morality about killing people, so they can also enforce traditional morality about sex. Well, in the 60s, elite secular opinion was that traditional sexual morality was backward, provincial, repressive. And the Supreme Court eventually determined that when states enforced this repressive morality, they were being not just repressive, but oppressive. That is, they oppressed women by denying them the right to birth control. Elite secular morality got forced upon a very morally mixed nation through the power of the court. The court had only to imagine a right to privacy, read it into the Constitution, because the Constitution is a living document after all, and then apply that to birth control.
Is this an example of how culture is upstream from politics, but in a way that the framers would never have intended.
Exactly. That's precisely the point. Culture is supposed to flow down into the political branches of the government, the legislative and executive branches. But the judicial branch is supposed to be quite insulated from politics and therefore from cultural influence. They, those on the court, are supposed to be concerned with the words of the Constitution and exercising reason without passion. But with a living Constitution, elite secular culture has exercised a controlling influence over politics around the country through the vehicle of the Supreme Court.
So I wonder if this could serve as an example. Chief Justice Roberts, I think if you had him in a private moment and asked him about the landmark decision of Roe v. Wade, whether or not it was a good decision, I think he'd probably say, well, no, of course not. Not only for the moral reasons, but the court was just doing stuff. They were making stuff up. And I think if you asked him if it could be squared with the Constitution or even read out of the Constitution in any way whatsoever, I think he would again say no. But he is popularly believed to be reticent about addressing Roe precisely because of not just offending kind of the secularist morality, but causing an uproar in the states. Is that an example of what we're talking about here?
Sure. It's at least a partial example, because as you point out, it's partly to not upset the secular elite, but it is also partly to not bring too much inflammation of problems in the states, like a conflagration. I think if there were suddenly an overturning of Roe v. Wade, there would be a tremendous outcry from the left to federal legislature, to state legislatures. It would be very divisive. And I think people like Chief Justice Roberts are hesitant to create that kind of riotous situation. Now, that doesn't serve as an excuse, or at least not an adequate excuse to my way of thinking, but it isn't something that we can ignore if we're being prudent. So, I would love to see the overturning of Roe v. Wade for the sake of the unborn. At the same time, we should not underestimate the societal problems that could cause, and the backlash in the form of legislation that protects a woman's right to choose more so than in many states it is now. So, for instance, Texas is a state that is somewhat known for having some of the most restrictive abortion laws, to the extent that they can be restrictive under Roe v. Wade and the cases that came after Roe v. Wade. If there were an overturning of Roe v. Wade, it might be that there's such an outcry within the states that states like Texas would adopt legislation that is less protective of the unborn than exists right now. So a prudential approach might actually be in the best interests of the unborn. I hate to say it that way because I can't stand the way things are now, but it's often more fraught and difficult than we like to think.
Well, it goes back to the principle that has run through our conversation in the last several episodes, and that is often in attempting to address a real problem, even under the Constitution, attempts to solve the problem may exacerbate it or create a new one.
Yes, that is true. And as Christians, we, of course, like to think in completely absolute terms when it comes to things like murder and including murder of the unborn. And we're right to do so. But when it comes to what actually happens on the ground, what are we doing in the legislative halls across the country, including in D.C. and including in the various state capitals, sometimes give and take will actually help the situation more. A more gradual approach can help more. And that's actually what I expect to see at the Supreme Court level. I don't think that Justice Kavanaugh is nearly as conservative as the left painted him last fall. So I anticipate a more gradual approach from the Supreme Court that will be less upsetting to civil society.
So how did the court's changing view of the contents of rights, in other words, as you said before, not reading rights out of the Constitution, but reading rights into the Constitution. How did that progress? How would you track that for us?
Okay, well, we had started with birth control, and as secular morality continued to decay, the court's views of what rights the Constitution protected changed too. So after birth control came abortion, and eventually then came homosexual rights, and eventually then the right for homosexuals to marry. The court saw each of these in its turn as a right previously unrecognized, but now discovered in the new cultural context. The Constitution had to evolve to encompass that right and enforce it against the states, or else the Constitution itself would be seen as no longer fitting the culture. It would no longer be relevant. In this way, the Constitution that had permitted each state to regulate moral behavior in accordance with the will of the people of that particular state had evolved into a weapon against the states in the secularist war on traditional culture.
I have to ask at this point, and maybe the answer is obvious, I'm not necessarily seeing it. Why not pursue the establishment of these assumed rights through the amendment process? Why bypass the amendment process, even irrespective of a living constitution approach?
I think mainly because there was very little prospect of getting the requisite number of states to approve an amendment. So it was really just a matter of how can we succeed in making our views the views of everyone, or at least the way life is lived out everywhere in America. It was pragmatic.
We're concluding our series on the U.S. Constitution on this Thursday afternoon with Dr. Russell Dawn, director of the pre-law program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. When we come back, the Equal Rights Amendment was a kind of a last gasp of progressives trying to use the amendment process.
The principal concern of bad revisionist history, however, is not the past, but the present. By reading present concerns into the past, bad revisionism shirks the responsibility imposed by the six C's of historical thinking.
Dr. Mark Kaltoff, speaking at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Whenever one encounters what may seem a compelling historical narrative, he or she must ask, is the narrator sensitive to the realities of change over time, of continuity, of context, of causality, of the contingency of human events, and finally of the staggering complexity of the past? If so, then the historical narrative is likely reliable.
You can listen to Dr. Kaltoff's presentation, Making the Case Against Revisionist History, on a recording of this year's Making the Case conferences. We'll send it to you for a year-end tax-deductible gift of $300. Place your order at issuesetc.org.
Continuing education for the Confessional Lutheran. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at lutheracademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth. Luther Academy, 260-452-2211 or lutheracademy.com.
Interested in missions and evangelism? You won't want to miss the January issue of The Lutheran Witness. Learn how the Apostles' Creed informs personal evangelism. Get to know Theodore Nather, the first overseas LCMS missionary. Hear about how one church planter is sharing the gospel in an unreached corner of Albuquerque and discover anew what it truly means to be Lutheran and unashamed. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Visiting Concordia University Chicago is a great way to open up your world. Tour our beautiful 40-acre campus, hear from current students about why they chose Concordia Chicago, discover more than 70 degree programs, and learn about financial aid and generous scholarship opportunities. Attend our February 18th visit day for high school and transfer students. Register today at cuchicago.edu/visit.
Several Issues Etc. regular guests are candidates for leadership positions in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Every LCMS congregation has received nomination forms for the president and vice presidents of the synod. Please encourage your pastor and congregational leaders to fill out and return these nomination forms before February 20th of 2019. Learn more at issuesetc.org/nominations. issuesetc.org/nominations. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're concluding our series on the U.S. Constitution, talking about the idea of a living Constitution with Dr. Russell Dawn. He holds a Juris Doctor degree from the University of Colorado and is a contributor to The Federalist. Dr. Dawn, we were talking before the break about why the progressives have not attempted to make the changes to establish the rights that they believe should be established through the regular amendment process in the Constitution. I'm putting me in mind of the Equal Rights Amendment, which was a valiant attempt, but it eventually did not see the light of day. Was it a last gasp of progressives attempting to use the amendment process?
With the change in the personnel on the Supreme Court, with Kavanaugh, who I believe is probably more conservative than Kennedy had been, with that change in the Supreme Court, we might actually see more attempts to amend the Constitution, since the Supreme Court is no longer in the pocket of the secularists and is no longer effectively an arm of their movement. Yeah, they'll try whatever means they can. And so that might be, you know, an amendment process.
So you caution that we should not forget what was happening in the states while this evolution was taking place.
Yes. Well, some states were restricting birth control and then abortion and then marriage, but other states were not. And so states that were culturally like, let's say, New York, were free to embrace and encourage all of these things, while states that were culturally more conservative, like maybe Tennessee or something like that, were free to discourage these things. The people of each state could live according to their own culture. And those who preferred a different culture would vote to change things or else vote with their feet by moving to a state with a better fit. What the Supreme Court did was to tell the more morally conservative states that they had to conform to the morality of the more liberal states. And this was all enabled by the concept of a living constitution. It will be interesting to see what happens to the idea of a living constitution in the future, now with the new makeup of the Supreme Court.
Are you saying that it's possible that, at least for a time, secular progressives might abandon the notion or put it on the shelf because they do not see the Supreme Court as an avenue for advancing their agenda?
That's possible in some circles. They may see, because now the precedents have been set more by the left than by the right. And so now that there are more, you know, that there's a 5-4 conservative majority on the Supreme Court, they don't want to see some of those precedents overturned. And the idea of a living constitution could be used to overturn some of those precedents. Well, that was our understanding of rights back then, but it's not really our understanding of rights now. So you may see some on the left arguing against a living constitution. That being said, I think ultimately they will seek to either make the Supreme Court irrelevant, there are movements in that direction already, or to take it back into being an arm of the left.
It's a very interesting situation you're talking about there, because I would want to assume that the justices sitting on the Supreme Court who have been railing against the living constitution interpretation for decades would not suddenly say, aha, now we can use it to advance our agenda. I think as a matter of principle, they'd say, no, it's a bad idea either way. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I think that's right. Certainly, you're not going to see Justice Thomas or Justice Alito suddenly embracing the idea of a living constitution. That being said, it still may be a concern on the part of some on the left, because they may not trust, and probably wouldn't trust, those on the right to remain true to their principles.
So tell us, why should Christians care about the Constitution and what happens to it?
Well, the Constitution is important to us as Christians because good governance is a gift from God. In other words, the Constitution has provided us generally good governance, deeply flawed in many ways, but still good overall, for over 200 years. That goodness has been a gift from God because it has enabled people of any faith or no faith at all to live in relative peace, prosperity, and security from generation to generation. God's blessing in this secular realm, this left-hand realm, has fallen abundantly like rain on the righteous and the unrighteous alike. Our good constitutional governance has also allowed us the freedom to worship God and serve our neighbors as we see fit in accordance with our Christian faith. Thus, good governance has supported God's provision for the faithful, for Christians, in the sacred or right-hand realm. There's, of course, no guarantee that this good governance will continue. As we discussed early in the series, the American founding, including the Constitution, was a creature of a complex blend that included, well, first the Enlightenment idea of natural rights, then the English development of classical thought, Greek and Roman thought, on the idea of higher law, or we could say natural law, that's binding on everyone, including the highest among us. The third piece that was sort of in the mix at the founding was the Christian idea that we're fallen, and therefore we must not trust our impulses, but instead must curb our impulses. And then finally, a generally Christian moral culture. The nation was never officially Christian, but it was culturally Christian. The founders believed that all of these elements, natural rights, natural law, a distrust of human impulses, and a Christian moral culture were necessary in order to achieve and to sustain ordered liberty. Liberty stands with these elements and falls without them.
How does a secularized culture aim at the demolition of precisely those four elements you just mentioned?
Well, today, in the realm of natural rights, natural rights focus on individuals, and they're being replaced by identity-based rights that focus on groups. So that's part one. Next, natural law. That's all but eclipsed in the public square by the idea that there's no stable moral nature to humanity, and thus my nature might differ from yours, and therefore we've no right to judge each other's moral values or preferences. Next, the notion of fallenness is completely out of favor. We now believe that we're basically good, which means that our impulses, especially our sexual impulses, are trustworthy, and that it is good that we follow wherever our impulses lead, with consent being the only limiter of that. And then finally, Christian culture retreats, of course, a little bit farther into obscurity every year. So really, we're left with two possibilities now. Either the founders were incorrect that ordered liberty must stand on these four elements, in which case the future of liberty in America is bright. We don't need those four elements, so watching them go away is not a matter of watching our liberty go away. Or the founders were correct, and as the defeat of the four elements becomes ever more thorough, so ordered liberty will eventually be defeated, or perhaps is being defeated as we speak, bit by bit.
I have a couple follow-up questions for you. The first one has to do with those four pillars that you were describing there, and how you use them to essentially show the direction of progressive secularism. Dr. Don, that is a book right there. That is an outline for a book. I don't know if it's original with you, but I'd get working on it.
Okay.
If I were you, because you have, in one paragraph, you have shown how secular progressivism strikes at the very foundation of principles that the founders not only would have taken for granted, but would have clearly articulated themselves.
Well, I have a sabbatical next fall. Perhaps that's the direction I'll take it.
So the other thing is you had just tossed in there something that I found interesting, that secular progressivism says we can trust our impulses, that our fallenness is either not real or not a problem, and that we could go wherever our impulses take us, consent being the only limiter. But isn't consent itself, isn't that notion grounded in both natural rights and natural law that progressivism also seeks to overturn?
Yeah, absolutely it is. This is part of the inconsistency within progressivism. And it's remarkable to me, this idea that we're basically good, at least how it's manifested in the modern era, goes back to early Enlightenment thought, especially on the French side. And it has gained steam over the generations. And it's remarkable to me because not only can any person of any self-awareness see that they themselves are not basically good, that their impulses can't be trusted, but study history even a little bit, and especially if you study it a lot, it's just obvious that impulses cannot be trusted, that humanity, the idea of the fall is so abundantly proven in history that, like I say, I just can't believe that people fool themselves into that notion. And then as they are trying to apply that notion to their political worldview, it's always inconsistent because they're always carving out little exceptions without acknowledging that those are exceptions. And this consent being the only limiter is an example of this. So what you'll hear about is toxic masculinity. What we really need to do, the reason men are predatory is that their masculinity is toxic. It's been taken to extremes that are not natural and not healthy. And so we just need to re-educate men and get them to give up these toxic notions of masculinity. Once we've done that, then they can live naturally and in a non-predatory manner. Really, the obvious thing is that men and women are fallen and that no amount of re-education is going to change that fact.
Dr. Russell Dawn is our guest, Associate Professor of History and Political Thought and Director of the Pre-Law Program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. We're concluding our series on the U.S. Constitution, talking about a living constitution. We'll discuss intersectionality after this. "'Twas the night before Jesus, when all through the earth every creature was stirring for a new baby's birth. Words from The Night Before Jesus, Concordia Publishing House's new Christmas book. The Night Before Jesus would make a great Christmas gift for children, grandchildren, and godchildren ages 3 through 5. Browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December, The Night Before Jesus.
Lutheran Federal Credit Union was formed to serve you and to serve the church. During December, when you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs or when you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to their Ministry of the Month, Ministry Focus. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Lutheran FCU, good for you, good for the church. LutheranFCU.org.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Rocking around the Christmas tree.
Have a holly jolly Christmas.
It's the most wonderful time.
Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle bell.
Tired of an endless loop of pop Christmas music? Coming December 24th, sacred music for the Christmas season, LutheranPublicRadio.org. Serenity. Stability. Solemnity. Lutheran Public Radio, sacred music for the Christmas season, coming Christmas Eve at LutheranPublicRadio.org.
We're talking about the idea of a living constitution in the conclusion of our series on the U.S. Constitution with Dr. Russell Dawn. He's Associate Professor of History and Political Thought and Director of the Pre-Law Program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. He holds a Juris Doctor degree from the University of Colorado and is a contributor to The Federalist. If you've benefited from our series on the U.S. Constitution with Dr. Dawn, please make a year-end tax-deductible contribution to support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. No gift is too small. You can donate online at issuesetc.org or by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois 62234. With 2 weeks left in 2018, we're $35,000 short of projected expenses. Thanks for listening and thanks for thinking of Issues Etc. when you consider your year-end giving. Dr. Dawn, let's talk a little bit about what has become the word of the day, really, for secular progressivism, and that's intersectionality, the idea that everyone occupies various identities based upon race, gender, and all those other things, and that everyone is simultaneously in kind of a big Venn diagram, simultaneously both oppressed and oppressor. Would that idea have ever occurred to the framers of the Constitution?
Right. I seriously doubt that it would have. Partly because, for the most part, they lived in a racially homogeneous society. Africans were largely confined to slavery. Native Americans were not well integrated into society. So they weren't really thinking in very racial terms the way we do now in such a mixed society. So really, when we talk about people of that era as racists, it's a little bit anachronistic because they just didn't deal with race on a daily basis the way we do now. But beyond that, they knew what oppression was. They had lived under oppression, and they studied history well, and so understood a history of oppression. And so they just, I think in America, we've become this idea of a victim culture. We really embrace victimhood. And I think that's partly because for many of us, the kind of suffering and the kind of oppression that occurs around the world and throughout most of history just isn't part of our daily experience. And so we embrace sort of a victim culture. And that would have been absolutely foreign to, and was foreign to, the founders in an era where it was much more the idea that we overcome the things, the problems that are in front of us.
You introduced the choice, really, a few moments ago between the two possibilities, that either the founders were incorrect and that ordered liberty does not need the four elements that you mentioned there of natural rights and natural law and the suspicion of human impulses and the general kind of Christian ethos that underlies our society, or that they were right, and we're going to watch those things diminish ever more so. Is it possible, Dr. Dawn, that progressive secularism is not aimed at ordered liberty at all, but a different kind of liberty?
I would say not a different kind of liberty, but really a different kind of order. I don't think that secular progressivism really aims very much at liberty at all. There's a saying to the effect of, you know, liberals don't care what you do as long as it's mandatory, something to that effect. So I'm not positive that the hard left in this country is really after liberty. I think they're much more after equality of outcomes, so that no one feels oppressed in their own mind, whether they're actually oppressed or not. We want no one even feeling oppressed. We want no one even feeling marginalized. All outcomes have to be equal. In order for that to happen, there's going to be a loss of liberty because, frankly, in earthly terms, we aren't very equal. There are people who are more ambitious, more talented, and more connected, and people who are less of all of these things. So I think that secular progressivism is really aimed at equality of outcome rather than genuine liberty. And to be clear about my statements earlier about the suffering, I don't mean any of this to diminish the real suffering that does happen within America. But just in terms of a broad experience, you know, what is the mainstream? Well, the mainstream is considerably less suffering and less oppression than has been experienced in earlier generations. I applaud the notion that we should work against suffering, work against oppression in governmental form, but also in just civil societal form, that people should try to diminish other people's suffering and diminish their role in other people's suffering. Absolutely. But when we exalt equality of outcome to such a level, we can really only achieve that kind of equality by a leveling downward. Schultzenitzen talks about socialism as a leveling down unto death, or something to that effect. And really, that's the problem with the secular progressivism, is ultimately we have to be leveled downward in order for us all to be level.
One of the biggest concerns that arises in my mind, for as we've talked about these things and the striking away at the foundations of a constitutional idea of ordered liberty by secular progressivism, is religious liberty. What do you make of prominent political figures using the term freedom of worship instead of the free exercise of religion, the constitutional language?
Yes, I think there are two possibilities there. Some prominent figures say it because they've heard it. I don't know exactly how far back it goes, but I do know that it's a term that Franklin Roosevelt used back in the 1940s, I think, in one of his, I think, a State of the Union address or something. I can't remember exactly. But so he talked about freedom of worship. So some people are just repeating it because they've heard it and they think that it's that the term has no special meaning. But others are using it with a special meaning, with a diminished meaning. And the idea is that freedom of religion really is only freedom of worship, and any other religious aspect that needs to be protected is protected by the speech clause in the First Amendment, so freedom of speech. So really, only worship becomes protected, rather than the idea of living out our faith in the public square on a day-to-day basis. So taking it to the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, well, sure, he has freedom of worship, but he doesn't have freedom to live out his religion in his worldly vocation that brings him an income. There, he has to conform so that nobody's sensibilities are hurt and everybody can go about being equally unoffended.
A frequent guest on our program for many decades is Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. And as far as I can tell, he has coined this idea of America and other societies, but in particular America, living on the, he calls it the borrowed capital of Christianity.
Yes.
And it sounds like that's exactly what you are describing, that we are seeing kind of the end game of what it looks like for a nation to live thusly.
Yes, I think that's a great insight on his part. He's not the only one to talk about it. I know, again, Alexander Schultzenitzen talked about this in a famous speech he gave in 1978 to the Harvard graduating class. He talks about how really the humanism that was inherent in the American founding was tempered, if you will, by also a Christian understanding. And that Christian understanding is what led to, for instance, the division of powers, the separation of powers in the Constitution, this understanding that we cannot trust our impulses, and also that we could have this kind of freedom because we lived in a largely Christian culture. As that culture decays, and as the notions of the imago Dei, that we're made in the image of God, and that is why we treat one another well, why we die to ourselves for the sake of someone else, is because they are also made in God's image. When that idea goes away, there's really nothing left. And so right now, we really aren't seeing any sort of broad base of support for violence against Christians, for instance, or violence against conservatives. There are little bits here and there, but there's no broad base of support for that. But that's for now. We still have that borrowed capital of Christianity. And as that goes away more and more, who knows what we'll see in terms of support for violence.
Very briefly, does that say something to Christians that it's up to us to maintain that capital?
Absolutely. I spend a lot of time, I spend the majority of my work time on matters of the left-hand kingdom, matters of the Constitution and liberty and that sort of thing. But as Christians, and myself as a Christian, everyone who is a Christian, we need to be working on the culture. And that happens face-to-face, relationship by relationship. So our own children, but also making sure that the people next to us in the pew are actually Christian, you know, talking with them. I don't mean we need to like hound our neighbor, you know, in the pew. Did you really listen to that sermon? But, you know, there are enough people sitting in the pews who are just there because that's what they do on a Sunday morning that they could bear to hear. It would be good for them to hear law and gospel outside of church as well as in church. Our neighbors at work, people need to hear the gospel of Jesus Christ, which transforms lives for eternity and in this life. And so we need to be sharing the gospel and having kids and raising them in the gospel. The future is not determined. I sometimes talk to my students about the early Roman Empire and the growth of Christianity there. Well, a lot of the growth of Christianity happened in this transformation of the culture, sort of demographically, finding babies who had been abandoned to die, as was a common practice among pagans in Rome, and adopting them into Christian families. That's one fewer pagan and one more Christian. And that is part of how Christianity grew in the Roman Empire. We can transform the culture generation by generation. We have to see it as an intergenerational struggle and one that matters in our most personal lives, how we have a family, how many we have in our family, and how we raise our kids, but also in our public lives with those around us.
Dr. Russell Dawn is Associate Professor of History and Political Thought and Director of the Pre-Law Program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. He holds a Juris Doctor degree from the University of Colorado and is a contributor to The Federalist. Dr. Dawn, you've been very generous with your time in this series. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Todd. It's been my pleasure.
Having trouble deciding what to get the Lutheran in your life? Why not give them a gift certificate from Concordia Publishing House? You can learn more at cph.org, cph.org. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Year. That's not Soundbite of the Week, but it is the top vote getters during all of our soundbites of the week from 2018. Brought together five of them for Soundbite of the Year and an Issues Etc. tradition. What's your favorite Christmas hymn and why? Vote in advance for Soundbite of the Year and for your favorite Christmas hymn at facebook.com/issuesetc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
This Christmas, bring your family and friends to experience a reenactment of the Christmas story in Journey to the Manger, an interactive Christmas experience.
Enjoy a live nativity, warm drinks and cookies, and live music performed by student groups.
From 5 to 8 p.m. on December 21st, come to Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois to enjoy this Christmas experience for all ages.
Admission is free, and when you donate $25 or more, you'll also receive a custom piece of art made by our students.
For more information,
call 618-656-0043.
Merry Christmas!